From cosmetic surgery to euthanasia, Daniel Sokol offers a unique insight into the world of medical ethics. Drawing on his experience as a leading medical ethicist and barrister and years of frontline experience in hospitals, Daniel sheds a light on the ethical complexities of modern medicine and guides us towards a better understanding of morality. It's the subject of a new book out by him called Tough Choices. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, author of Tough Choices, Daniel Sokol. Daniel, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us, and thanks for joining us. It is a subject that is becoming more and more prominent, the story of where we stand in terms of morality and ethics with regard to medicine. What have you discovered, or what are your thoughts on where we stand at the moment with regard to several issues that are making the news medical-wise?
Yeah, well, it's increasingly relevant because medicine is increasingly capable. Medicine can do things now that even 20 years ago it couldn't do. It can keep people alive that would have been dead much sooner. And as medicine becomes more sophisticated and more powerful, more potent, it brings in ethical issues that may not have been as prominent before. So we have ethical issues relating to developments in technology, for example, face transplants that, of course, weren't possible years ago, but which are possible now, and transplantation of larynxes and things like that. But we also have the more traditional ethical issues that are still very much there, like euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide. Issues such as whether doctors should always tell patients the truth, which have been there since Hippocratic times. When is it okay for doctors to breach confidentiality? Again, that's an age-old issue. And also issues relating to consent are very common these days. And I'm also a barrister, a medical lawyer, and I'm getting more and more cases involving consent because it's the law is evolving on what consent requires, and it's not fully understood by doctors and patients. So yeah, there are a range of ethical issues from the very high-tech to the more low-tech, but they are increasingly common. And what the thesis of the book is that it's become so complicated now that we need professional clinical ethicists in hospitals, just like there are in America. In America, if you're a doctor and you need ethical advice, you can bleep an ethicist who will come to the ward and help you resolve your ethical dilemma.
Right. I often get this with the technology debate and the fact that, you know, technology is moving quicker than our legal constraints are doing. But obviously, I hadn't really thought of this because of the advances that we've made in medicine, prolonging life, and the variety of, as you said, face transplants, etc., and consent. It's a case then that the legal profession is having to play catch up with the advances in medicine.
Well, that's a thorny question as to whether or not the law has caught up with it. I mean, the law changes because society changes. And so, for example, in relation to consent, the law recently has changed. It used to be, well, is this in keeping with a responsible body of medical opinion? So it was very much the medical establishment who determined what information should be disclosed to the patient, for example. Well, the law has changed in England and Wales, and now doctors have to disclose material risks of treatment and the risks of reasonable alternatives. And it's not necessarily the doctor who decides what's a material risk. It's what a reasonable person or what the patient would consider to be a reasonable risk. And that varies from person to person. So, for example, I have my brother-in-law is an ear, nose, and throat surgeon, and he used to tell me that if there's a 1% risk or more of complication, he would tell the patient, and if it's less than 1%, he wouldn't tell the patient. And I said to him, look, you're asking for trouble here. He's changed his practice now, but you're asking for trouble because if you're operating on the head sommelier of the fat duck, a luxury restaurant, then it may be that a 0.5% chance of losing your sense of smell may be very relevant to this individual. So you can't have a rule of thumb like 1% or more, because now the law has changed and it depends on the individual patient and what's important to them.
And I mean,
so that's an example of how the law has, you know, tracked changes in societal expectations.
And how much input should a patient have then on their treatment? Because obviously now everybody can go to their tablet, to their phone, and you probably shudder at the thought of, you know, doing their own diagnosis by their search engine. But, you know, people have the information out there, and a lot of time they say, well, I've seen this on the internet.
Yeah, well, patients are much more informed than they used to be, not always accurately informed, I must say, but it does raise problems sometimes for clinicians, because in some conditions, the patient may know more than the patient, may know more than the doctor. So there is a change in the dynamic between doctors and patients. There used to be a huge power differential and differential in knowledge, but that has evened out. And also that, you know, in our society anyway, the respect that's been afforded, the deference that's been afforded to doctors is also changing. Mm. And it's much more of a flat hierarchy than it used to be, where, you know, doctor knows best used to be the dominant theory. And certainly I've spent some time in parts of India where that is still, you know, the dominant approach, doctor knows best, and, you know, patients shouldn't ask any questions because it's rude and so on. But in our culture, that's very much changed, and patients are much more willing to challenge doctors about decisions that they make, including decisions in the end of life, which is why we have these very high-profile cases that we had recently. You may remember Charlie Gard and Alfie Evans earlier this year, where you have babies, and it's particularly emotional because you've got young children and babies who are at the end of life and essentially dying, and there's huge disagreements between the family, who understandably want everything done for the child, and the clinicians, who may think that actually there's no benefit anymore of continued treatment and potential harm. And they don't agree. When they don't agree, they have to go to court, and it becomes a very public affair.
Mm. The thing with the public affair with that, and looking back at the Alfie case, is the fact that, and it must be difficult for professionals in this case, because somebody will come out of, you know, Eastern Europe or something saying, I've got a cure for this child. If you give me this amount, we can send it away. It's only a 0.5% chance. The family will always say, we'll do anything to try and save our son. And as in the Alfie case, there was a massive social media presence. You know, the establishment was seen as not caring. It made front page and, you know, 24-hour news via the networks. It's a very, very difficult case to deal with, because the medical profession is seen as being uncaring, and the quote unquote establishment is being seen as uncaring.
Yeah, absolutely. And the voice that you hear is not so much the voice of the clinicians, because they essentially communicate to the public via press releases, very controlled press releases, and they don't have the same freedom of communication that the family have, for example. So there is an unequal playing field in that front in terms of communication with members of the public. But you're right. I mean, one of the problems, I consider it a problem, is that you could always find some clinician somewhere who will say, well, I think there's a chance. And the family will cling on to that, understandably perhaps, and that will create all sorts of problems and tensions which, if they're intractable, have to end up in front of the referee, which is the court. And that's traumatic for everyone involved. Mm. And tremendously expensive as well. But yes, I mean, I think, again, and that is linked to what we talked about earlier, about the fact that we can now keep people alive and babies alive, that wouldn't have been kept alive 10, 20 years ago because the technology just simply wasn't there.
But this again, this is the great thing about, you know, quality of life as opposed to, if you like, lifespan. And it, you know, you might be able to keep somebody alive for another 20 years, but if they're in a degenerative mental state or physical state, is it fair? Is it a drain on resources? Everybody wants to try and live for as long as ever, but surely it is the quality and not the quantity of life, and that's something that medical professionals are having to face.
Well, absolutely, and you know, there's that distinction between, well, you know, we can do it, but should we do it? And I remember when I was in America a few years ago, this patient had died, a cancer patient, and the lead clinician was reading out to the committee all the interventions that had been done on this woman before she died. And he read out this long list, and at the end he said, gosh, it's difficult to die in this hospital. And I think it's because of that concern that more and more people are drawing up what's called an advanced decision, which says, you know, if I'm in this condition, if I'm locked in, for example, and I have mental capacity, or it looks like I've got mental capacity, but I can't communicate, and it's clear that I'm in pain, then I don't want any life-prolonging intervention. Mm. Or if I'm terminally ill and there's no prospect of any meaningful recovery and I can't communicate and so on, then I don't want any life-prolonging. More and more people are making these advanced decisions or advanced statements because they are concerned that they will be kept alive for longer than they want to be in a state that for them isn't really a life. It's just there's biological life, but there's no real biographical life. There's no real meaning to it. You're just alive.
And the other thing,
many people.
The other thing that struck me, you've brought up this point, and made me have a second look at it, because it's confidentiality. Now, confidentiality between a doctor and a patient, I always thought was sacrosanct and was untouchable. But of course, there are conditions. If you are a public driver, for example, on a bus or a train or whatever, when perhaps that doctors should be allowed to break the confidentiality agreement. Explain a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Hippocratic Oath talks about confidentiality, and this was in the 4th and 5th century BC about how it's important for doctors to keep their patients' secrets. Because if that's not there, that patients may be very reluctant to talk to their doctors about potentially embarrassing things or things which they don't want other people to know, and it will be difficult then for doctors to treat them accurately because they don't have all the information or treat them appropriately. But it's generally accepted that the rule of confidentiality is not absolute, that there are cases, maybe when there's, you know, serious risk of significant harm to others, where a doctor should breach confidentiality as a last resort. So if you went to your GP, for example, and it was plain that you had Ebola, hemorrhagic fever, and you told him that you were looking forward to your trip to the cinema and then going to the public swimming pool afterwards for a quick swim, then you can see how the doctor there would say, well, I'm terribly sorry, but I'm going to have to inform the authorities that you have Ebola, and you certainly shouldn't go to the cinema and go swimming. But so there are limits to confidentiality. The question is, where is that bar? Mm. I mean, I had a client call me the other day on a Saturday morning, and she said, Daniel, I need your help. I've been the victim of domestic abuse. And I've written this up, so it's in the public domain. My husband of several years slapped me around the face and he grabbed my throat. He'd never done this before. My two children, who were 7 and 2, were in bed at the time. And I went on the internet, and the internet said, I need to go and see my GP. So she went to see her GP the next day. And the GP tried very much to encourage my client to tell the authorities about it. But my client said, absolutely not. I want this marriage to work. And so the doctor said, well, in that case, you know, because of doctor-patient confidentiality, I can't say anything, but I do encourage you to tell somebody about this. And then a few days later, two or three days later, she got a knock on the door. And there were 4 police officers who came into the house and arrested her husband in front of the children. He was screaming and crying and saying, where are you taking my daddy, and so on. And the GP had told social services, who then informed the police about this, and there was this very dramatic arrest. And so the question there was it acceptable for the GP to breach this person's confidentiality on the grounds that she was the victim of domestic abuse and that, you know, there were children in the household who potentially were at risk? Or was that a betrayal of the patient, an unacceptable breach of confidentiality? That's a very real, practical, ethical issue that GPs face on a regular basis.
I mean, the thing is, looking at the moral dilemmas that you bring up in your book, Tough Choices, doctors and practitioners have enough on their plates at the moment with funding, with patient numbers. I mean, you talk about should you be able to restrain patients? I mean, we hear about some horrendous stories about having an A&E. This is just another weight on a doctor's and a practitioner's shoulders. Surely this horrible moral compass.
Well, you know, the size of medical ethics textbooks increases every year. And the British Medical Association has one, which is probably 1,000 pages long. I collect these books, and if you go back to the 19th century, early 20th century, they tend to be much thinner volumes, and that's because it's getting a bit more complicated. But you know, there was a change in the 1990s where there's a rule that every medical school has to teach medical ethics now, at least in the UK. So every new doctor should have some training in medical ethics. But, you know, that doesn't come close to capturing all the ethical issues. It's a superficial overview of the key ethical issues. But it's you're absolutely right, which is why I think that the North American system, which is having in-house or hospital-based ethicists to assist the clinicians with some of the particularly thorny ethical problems, or even when the ethical problems haven't really arisen yet, but you can sense that there's something going on. And sometimes, especially when you've got disputes between family and doctors, you can sense that there's a change in communication. The family aren't asking as many questions, or you can sense a brewing ethical dilemma. And then again, you can nip it in the bud. You can get the ethicist involved to try to talk through a problem before it explodes into a massive problem. I think there's definitely a place for professional ethicists in hospitals. The problem at the moment is funding, and publicly funded. You know, they say, well, isn't that just a luxury? But my argument is that it isn't a luxury. It's now a central part of clinical practice, of clinical care. It will help the morale of doctors who, as you say, already have enough on their plates. And if it can avoid a single lawsuit, then it would have paid for itself many times over.
I was going to say, I mean, no hospital is going to want to have a situation where you have the scenes of, as we have seen several times before, of, you know, bereaved families crying, the whole situation, the media thing that goes along with that, and the reputation. There's one thing I want to touch on very briefly as well, which is artificial intelligence, because this is a big thing. It is obviously only going to expand in terms of what it's doing in the medical profession. And again, there is, you know, a moral, there's an ethical dimension as well to the whole introduction of artificial intelligence in hospitals and treatments.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge field, the artificial intelligence, and it's not entirely clear, again, what the repercussions of that will be. I mean, you can see massive advantages to artificial intelligence. Now, I went to a radiology conference recently, and you can see the huge benefits that this would have in terms of interpreting scans or imaging, and how sophisticated these machines could become, and it could flag up or pick up tumors or other sinister lesions in ways that radiologists can only dream of in the future. And so there's lots of potential for good. I'm sure, as with all technology, there are potential for things going wrong, and these have to be thought about before they're implemented. But I certainly don't think we should resist artificial intelligence. I don't think there's any point, because it's going to come. The question is, how can we integrate it as safely as possible and as ethically as possible, so that it produces good and minimizes harm?
When you said a little bit earlier in the interview that the ethic books that you have and have been produced us, you know, now several thousand, almost several thousand pages long. When you sat down to write the book Tough Choices, how do you trim all of those issues and the complications into a reasonable and readable book like Tough Choices?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that you can cut down. You know, I talk a little bit about the law, but not much. And I focus really on the key ethical issues that may be of interest to members of the public. So I don't really talk about artificial intelligence at this point because I think it's a bit too premature. But I will talk about things like end-of-life decisions, about what makes life valuable and what sorts of how should we communicate this with the medical team? Because these are things that, even though we hope aren't going to affect us, it's possible that we step out today and get run over by a bus and we end up tetraplegic and in a coma. And suddenly it does become relevant, at least to our relatives and to the medical team. So I have tried to cover areas that are of practical relevance to all of us, or at least potential practical relevance to everybody, whether you're a doctor or a non-doctor, whether you're the patient or the relative, in the hope that it will raise awareness and perhaps make a positive difference should the situation come about for you.
The book is called Tough Choices. It's out now via Book Guild Publishing. It's by Daniel Sokol. Daniel, if people want to find out more information about you or the book, is there a website? Is there social media? Do you Twitter? How can people get in touch with you and find out more about what you're doing?
Yes, I am on Twitter at DanielSokol9, and feel free to get in touch if you have any questions about anything that's been raised today. And the Book Guild also has information about the book, and it's also on Amazon and all good bookshops.
And it will be available as a download as well via the Talk Radio Europe virtual bookshop. And that's S-O-K-O-L, isn't it, for your surname?
That's right.
The book is called Tough Choices. Daniel Sokol, it's been a pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you very much.